You're listening to the Legal Design Podcast. My name is Nina Toivonen.
And I am Henna Tolvanen. This is Legal Talk Out of the Box. In this episode, we talk about the role of legal education in making law better. Our guest today is Kat Moon. She's the Director of Innovation Design for the Program on Law and Innovation at Vanderbilt University. Kat is a thought leader of making law better, and she's an active tweeter and conversation starter on issues that all lawyers should focus on. Welcome to our show, Kat. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It is wonderful to be here.
Thank you for joining us, Kat. How are you? What have you been up to lately?
I am great. As you experienced last night, we had some storms coming through, and today is a bright, beautiful, sunny day. The sun is just streaming through the windows, so I'm grateful for that. So on this day, I'm great, but generally doing well, all things considered, on what is hopefully the tail end of this interesting pandemic experience. And right at the moment, I am caught up in finishing my semester at Vanderbilt Law School. So wrapping up two courses, and I'm thinking about what comes next.
Sounds good. Hey, Kat, you have been talking about change for quite a long time now. I was just wondering, have you ever considered yourself as a traditional lawyer, or did you know from the beginning of your career that there is a need to change things around in law, and you're going to be the one who's doing the change?
Yes, I do think I clued in pretty early on that the way things work definitely could be better. And so I was fortunate. I was able, a few years into my practice, to actually create a law firm with two other women that was very stakeholder-centered. So we figured out, what do we want from the practice? How do we want to structure our professional lives so it honors and allows us to have lives outside of our work?
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah. And how do we do it in a way that really serves clients well? So it certainly was client-centered, but it also was focused on how we wanted to work. And by the way, I think that those two things are completely compatible. And frankly, it's one of the problems I have with the phrase client-centered, because I think client-centered work can actually be very detrimental to the person doing the work. And so I, you know, human-centered, right? Stakeholder-centered. But back to your question, I did start out very traditionally, and this led me down the path that ended up where I am right now at Vanderbilt Law School. And I'm grateful for all of those opportunities. Absolutely, what I do now is completely informed by my experience as a practicing lawyer, and the things that I now teach and explore with my students, both at the JD level and out in the profession, because I also, you know, teach practicing legal professionals as well. All of these things are informed by my own work and things I did and learned in my own practice. So I'm grateful for that opportunity. It's also a little exhausting to always
be
kind of on that, you know, early adopter, first mover curve. There's that as well, but it's been a great experience. I'm fortunate.
Sounds great.
You're known for your enthusiasm to make law better. What elements does this better law have? So to say, what should we focus on, for example, in policymaking or providing legal services so that it would kind of meet the requirements of better law in your view?
So I think make law better is user-centered law, right? And so I can speak specifically to the U.S., and I'm making generalizations based on U.S. law right now. We currently have systems of justice and ways of practicing law that were designed and implemented in the second industrial revolution, That is a period of time that ended more than 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so these systems and ways of working and ways of helping people were designed for a time that no longer exists. We're now in the fourth industrial revolution, which is very much the opposite of life in the second industrial revolution. And so we are in this period of rapid technological advancement and change. We are connected at a micro and macro levels in a way that we have never been before. And the scope of change is so much wider. And so in these ways, it's simply a different time. And our systems are not fit for purpose anymore. And so from my perspective, Make Law Better is making our systems of justice and our systems of help providing legal help truly fit for purpose. And so making them user-centered. And, you know, again, in the U.S., we have ways of practicing. We have, you know, courthouses and processes that were all designed for and by judges and lawyers. They're not designed to accommodate the people who are at the core of the legal problems being handled. And so I think we have this obligation to redesign these systems and how we help people with their legal problems so that the way we're doing it is truly fit for purpose. In the U.S., the percentage of people who have a legal problem but never get any help with their problem ranges around 80%, if not higher, depending on the type of matter and the jurisdiction. And so we know that we're not even helping a quarter of the people who need help. And that is simply not acceptable. It's intolerable. And yeah. So how do we redesign? We make law better when we make our systems of justice and the way we help people fit for purpose. And it's just not right now. There are no indicators that are telling us we're doing a good job.
Yeah. That's true.
I mean, if you look at Hill's research, like Hill is doing, you know, great user-centered research on these very issues globally. And they've been doing some work in conjunction and collaboration with IELTS here in the US, and we'll be releasing that data soon, I think. So yeah, I mean, it's a global problem, absolutely. And which excites me in that if we're all struggling with the same challenges, just imagine the solutions we could design if we started working collaboratively. Because yeah. I think there's some commonality. Even when you have different systems of justice, we still are talking about how do we inform and empower humans yeah. of their legal rights, obligations, responsibilities, and how do we empower them to understand and have agency in solving their own problems, right? Because another challenge we have again in the U.S. is we have not even 1.5 million lawyers, and you know we have 22 million legal problems happening on any given day, and so there will never be enough lawyers to help every person who needs help with a legal problem. And so that's why I think the redesign to make law better, to make it fit for purpose, must start with how do we empower people to help themselves? And also, how do we expand the people who can help? So for instance, in the US, there are some jurisdictions that have experimented with using navigators. So they're not people who are lawyers, they're not JDs who've passed a bar exam, but they are trained to help self-represented litigants navigate a court system, a process, a procedure. And the outcomes, the data on those navigator programs shows that they are incredibly effective. So, you know, as in medicine, you know, you can again, here in the US, I can make an appointment with a nurse practitioner. And it's usually a lot easier and it's always cheaper for me to do that than to go see the doctor. And so I can make that choice. So I'm not forced to seek for a medical problem. I'm not forced to seek only one kind of professional. There are a range of professionals who can help me based on the nature of my problem. We need a similar system when it comes to providing legal help. And so I think that, you know, that's a critical component as well. It's a big topic.
Yeah, there's so many things to consider and so many points of views to look things from. And I think that if we want to make law better and change things around, it also requires some new skills from lawyers. So Kat, what do you think? What are the most important skills for a lawyer? And I'm pretty sure that legal expertise is and will always be needed. But what else does a lawyer need in order to be good or even great at their job and tackle the problems of today and the future?
Excellent question. And it's one that I think about a lot. I'm actually a collaborator on a model, a framework for legal professional competency. It's called the Delta Model. And folks can find out more about that at designyourdelta.com. It is a triangle. It represents Delta, the idea of change. And it is a visual representation of both traditional lawyering skills. And it is built to accommodate and really encourage people to think about, anticipate intentionally, what are the skills that lawyers are going to need going forward, based on the fact that we're in this fourth industrial revolution and given the change that is happening around us. So yes, agreed that traditional lawyering skills, the quote, think like a lawyer skills, are the foundation, right? And on the Delta, the triangle, they form the foundation. We call that the practice of law. And I think that law schools do a good job generally of imparting the think like a lawyer skills. So we can check that box. If you go to the right side of the triangle, we call that side process. And on that side are arrayed many skills that we believe and that research confirms, and research on lawyering, but also research anticipating what knowledge workers are going to need as the 21st century progresses, because lawyers, legal professionals, are knowledge workers. And so on that side, we have things like project management, process design and implementation and improvement, data analytics, fundamental business acumen, fluency with technology, if not fluency, at least comfort with technology.
And yeah, that's important.
Yes, yes. And in two ways, I will point out, so lawyers absolutely can supercharge their practice by using the technology that's already available to help them do their work better, more efficiently, and perhaps less expensively for clients. It is, I think, equally important to understand that for many lawyers, they need basic technology competency in order to do their actual legal work. Our clients are coming to us with issues that are increasingly including fairly sophisticated technological issues. And so for us to really be good counselors, we need to understand some fundamental things about technology that are relevant to the clients who we are serving. So I always like to point out, it's kind of that dual nature when it comes to technology fluency, or at least a comfort level with technology. So that's the process side, the right side. And then if we look at the remaining side, the left side of the triangle of the Delta, we call that the people side. And here are arrayed the skills that include emotional intelligence, curiosity, the traditional entrepreneurial skills that one has in order to thrive in ambiguity. We would also place many of the mindsets of human-centered design, the ability to collaborate effectively, not only within the profession, but with other professionals. That's critical. Problem solving in the 21st century is multidisciplinary. It's not just about a bunch of lawyers getting around a table and trying to solve the problem. As data shows and research is increasingly showing, when you problem solve with a group of people who are cognitively diverse, meaning they've been trained to problem solve in different ways, you get better solutions and you get them more quickly. And I believe we are ethically obligated to problem solve in the way that best solves our clients' problems. And that means really radical collaboration. So that's a critical skill as well. So if you look at the Delta holistically, you see that the three sides are equal in that we believe and research supports that these skills that are on the right and left side of the Delta are as important as your think like a lawyer skills. And the question really becomes, what does the particular role you're serving require? So I want to say there's, from the perspective of the Delta, in terms of thinking about competencies for legal professional, it should be role centric. So what does your particular role require? Some roles are going to lean more heavily on the traditional practice skills. Some roles, for instance, roles including legal engineer, legal designer, legal operations professional, those roles are going to require more emphasis and greater skill level and a wider range of skills on the process side and the people side, for instance. The other important thing I'll say, and I don't think that this is unique to the fourth industrial revolution and what that requires of lawyers. I think this has always been true. I just don't believe that as a profession, as a discipline, we have adequately recognized or supported the fact that our people skills are critical. Emotional intelligence, our ability to empathize with clients, these are skills that really good lawyers understood were important and developed. They are not skills that are explicitly emphasized, for instance, in traditional legal training in the US. Not that some programs don't provide them, but it's just not been explicitly recognized and really focused on and emphasized. I point out the people side because folks who are looking at these issues very intently and who are much smarter than I am, but looking at it from the perspective of knowledge workers, understand that as technology advances and is able to do some of the traditional quote lawyering work more efficiently and better in some instances than a human lawyer, this is going to require human lawyers to really emphasize their most human skills, our ability to exercise human judgment, our ability to empathize with other humans, our ability to collaborate, our ability to communicate meaningfully. And so I think that the quote rise of the robots simply challenges us to get better at being humans. And I think this absolutely will impact the legal profession and the skills that lawyers need to bring to the table.
Yeah, I think us lawyers are known for our legal jargon, and I think we're quite often criticized that it is impossible to understand us. And yeah, I get that. I'm one of them. And I read a quote from Bill Gates who said that if you can't explain something simply, you don't really understand it yourself. So Kat, do you think it's too harsh to think that the better lawyers are those who can make legal context understandable to laymen and not those who draft impressive hundreds of pages long contracts?
My answer will start with the intended purpose is the purpose of the communication, whether it's a contract or whether it is a memo or an email or a conversation, it is the communication fit for purpose. And in some instances, absolutely very sophisticated, heavy legal jargon documents may be required, given the context, right? And more often than not, we certainly could apply the tools, methods, and mindsets of human-centered design, of legal design, to make our communication much more user-friendly. You know, often I can recall as a practicing lawyer, I would look at, you know, something, a procedure, a statute, you know, something for the first time. And I would be like, geez, why is this written this way? And so I think there are a whole lot of reasons why the law, you know, there's the mindset it is that it has to be full of legalese and overly complicated and hard for anyone who's not trained in our special secret language to understand. You know, there are gatekeeping purposes for that. You know, and we are trained in law school to really, you know, to at least think that we're the smartest person in the room and that only lawyers can understand these things, you know, the whole mindset that if you don't have a law degree, if you're not a practicing lawyer, then your, you know, your take on something can't provide any value. I think that's one reason why that mindset of us versus them, right? Two flavors of people in the world, lawyers or not lawyers. I think that mindset is one of the reasons why we have so much trouble collaborating with other disciplines. But we absolutely have an obligation to make our communication, again, whether it's a written contract, a memo, something we say to a client, as accessible and user-friendly as possible. Is it fit for purpose? The purpose is not to be complicated. The purpose is not to make ourselves sound smart, to prove that we know this secret language that other people do not. There's a whole lot of ego involved in practicing law. And, you know, to the detriment, I think, honestly, of the people doing the work as much as the client. So it really is, I observe often we do our work in a lawyer-centric way, right? We don't do our work in a, I'll say client-centered way, you know, but the client, that meaning, that can take a few different meanings. And we certainly have created systems of justice that are lawyer-centric, that are judge-centric, that are legal system centric rather than centered on providing access and understanding to the folks we serve. So back to the Bill Gates quote, I think it's entirely possible that folks, that lawyers hide behind this, expertise and make things overly complicated on purpose. Like they think that that's the value they're providing, that they can speak in this secret language that others don't understand. And do I think that often lawyers don't fully understand all of it? Absolutely. I mean, just look at a multi-hundred page contract. Oh my gosh, I for many years, that was my world. And it was nightmarish. So I will also say from my own experience, one of the greatest gifts of the work I've been able to do at Vanderbilt for the past now 4 years is in teaching, I am learning so much. I believe that what Bill Gates says is true, that, you know something when you can explain it simply. And in this process of developing these courses and teaching students, have had to teach myself more. Like I thought I knew some things and I, you know, I know some stuff, but I've had to learn a lot more. And it was in that act of conveying to my students as simply and clearly as possible that I realized, gosh, I don't know this as well as I thought I did. And I, you know, I need to learn more. And so that's been really an enlightening experience. And it's led me, my mantra, it's my pinned tweet on Twitter, but it's a quote from a poem by Mary Oliver. The poem is called Luna. And the quote is, "I live in the open-mindedness of not knowing enough about anything." And for me, that describes humble curiosity. And I believe that humble curiosity is a core, if not the core mindset for human-centered design. I also believe that the way we traditionally train lawyers, at least in the U.S., does not inculcate or invite humble curiosity. In fact, quite the opposite. So in that regard, I think we have a lot of work to do. But I think if you have humble curiosity, you embrace your work exactly with that Bill Gates quote in mind.
To talk more about legal education, you teach law at Vanderbilt University, and we have heard many wonderful things about the way you teach law there. So how do you address the need for change in legal education? And for example, teach your students how to be humbly curious.
Yeah. So I really try to model for them what I'm hoping I empower them to go out and do. And by that, I mean simply that I am one person teaching, you know, at any given time. For instance, this academic year, I've taught three courses over the course of the year, which is a pretty standard load for me. So I'm just one person teaching my three courses. All the courses are limited enrollment, or at least they're supposed to be. Last semester, an error happened in registration, and instead of 24 students, I ended up with 120. Oh, but wow. Usually it's anywhere from 16 to 24 students. And so in a given, you know, academic year, I'm really not touching that many students. And I share that just to point out, like, I really have absolutely no explicit power to make change happen in law school curriculum. The only thing I can control, the only influence I can attempt to wield is through the courses I create and my teaching in those courses. And so that's one thing I try to model to my students, is that in making change, if you observe there is a problem, I believe that it is your obligation to do what you can to fix the problem, to make change, to do what you have, do what you can with what you have where you are, even absent explicit power and authority and influence. And a failure to do so is tacit support for the problem. And I also believe that anyone, no matter where they are, who they are, what they're doing, influence or not, has the capacity to make that change happen in the way that they choose to do their own work and the choices they make in their own lives. And so my goal is to empower my students to know that when they enter the profession, even as first-year associates in a law firm, which is where most of my students go, practically 90% go straight into a corporate law firm, even in that environment where they are literally the lowest lowest rung on the ladder, lowest on the totem pole, they will face choices and they will have opportunities to influence change. And it starts with their own sphere of control and the way they choose to do their work, how they choose to approach their work, how they choose to help the people that they have the opportunity to help, and how they engage their colleagues. And so that, to me, that's really the core element of what I try to do in my work at Vanderbilt. And again, I'm modeling it for my students. As I said, I have absolutely no real influence to make change happen in legal education. The only opportunity I have is what happens in my classrooms or my Zoom room these days, and my opportunity to influence students and empower them. And I believe in that I can affect change. And so I try to model that for my students.
Great answer. I like that. You don't have to do big things by, or like influence big change by doing big changes, because it starts with what you can do in real. Yes.
Yeah, small steps.
Yeah, I believe every one of us has the capacity to lead change, to lead innovation.
Exactly.
And our challenge is so enormous that it's going to take every one of us, you know, making choices in just in our daily work, in our daily lives, that work to make law better. Again, what can we control with what can we do with what we have where we are to achieve that purpose? And every single one of us has that opportunity. We just need to seek it out, and we need to have the courage to act in accord with our values.
True. Hey, one of the courses you teach is called Legal Problem Solving. And this is really intriguing for me and Nina, because we were just talking yesterday that this sounds something super practical. But for example, we both managed to get out of law school without ever seeing a real contract. And we know that
in law school,
actually, once. Because there was a discussion about this on LinkedIn, and apparently this is a real issue that we just graduate from law school with big ideas and we have no experience from the practical side. Like, what could it be?
Can you imagine this? Like, the doctors were educated without ever seeing a real body.
Yep. It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So Kat, do you want to tell us what the legal problem solving course is about, and what is the background story of starting this course?
Yes, well, I'll start with the background story, if that's okay. This was 2017, and I had reached a point in my practice. So I was close to 20 years into my practice, 19 years at that point. And I was just ready for a change. So I had made the decision to leave the practice of law as I had been doing it for almost two decades. You know, my husband, very supportive. I think he was very curious about what was going to happen next, but but thankfully very supportive. And so I essentially took, you know, kind of a gap year. I still have an active law license, by the way, although I avoid practicing law at all costs at this point. But I was winding down my practice, and it was a transactional practice, and I had a core set of clients that I did regular work for. And so I was able to kind of get them situated with new counsel, and was down to just working on one project with one client. And so I was lucky in that I was able to kind of phase that out. I didn't have to like give notice that I was like, okay, today's the day. And it really was just serendipity. I was prepared for an opportunity, and it was not one that I saw coming at all. I never would have predicted that what happened next was what was going to happen. But I was introduced to the dean at Vanderbilt Law School, the dean at the time, and he's still currently the dean, Chris Guthrie, in 2017. And at that time, Vanderbilt as a university had as an institutional focus human-centered design, and was bringing in design really across the university, across programs. And so the dean actually knew what that was and what it meant, and understood that the law school needed to be doing something with that as part of, if for no other reason, as part of the institutional mission. But our dean also very much understands that we have to be forward thinking in how we are training our lawyers. And so he was very curious about what this could look like in the law school curriculum and simply invited me in and said, hey, come teach a course, design it, teach it, just go. And I can say I've had really, full opportunity to create and teach since that time. And it started with this one course, Legal Problem Solving, which is at its essence a course in human-centered design. And I approach it in three ways with students over the course of a semester. And by the way, a single semester is wholly inadequate for our purpose, but it's what I have to work with. So we learn about the mindsets, tools, and methods of human-centered design. And so we look at different processes. We look at the IDEO five-step design thinking process. We look at double diamond, and then we look at all kinds of often user centered design. So service design tools, right? So we use things like empathy maps, journey maps, and tools like that. And so I start by introducing the students to this whole world of human centered design. And my experience, as well as my research, shows that before you can truly empathize and be an empathic designer in whatever field you are in, including legal, you must be a self-aware person. You must understand a whole lot of things about yourself that we typically don't go around during the day thinking about. And so I start with the students by helping them build self-awareness. So we start by actually applying these tools to themselves so they can start better understanding themselves and their professional journey. And I use that as a way to practice the tools. So they make their own journey maps so that they think very intentionally about what they are going into the practice of law to do. How did they get here? What are all these elements that impact the choices they may make? And these are the same things we do when we are creating a service to deliver, right? We think about this for our users. So I'm like, you are your own user. Like, how does this work for you? So we start there, and then we partner with, the partnerships have varied, the collaborations have varied over the years that I've taught the course, but we partner to then actually work on a true, typically kind of a legal services delivery challenge, but it looks a little bit different depending on the nature of the project that we create for the semester. And so it's an opportunity then to really apply these design mindset tools and methods to solving a real problem. And typically these projects are multidisciplinary. So I can give you an example. A couple of years ago, we worked with a group at Vanderbilt Medical Center, including mm-hmm. some medical students, some engineering students, some computer science students, to redesign the surgical informed consent process. So that process has legal elements, right? But it has a whole lot of other stuff mm-hmm. going on. Yeah. And so we brought together this multidisciplinary team and held a couple of different design sprints. And, we're able to use, again, a lot of the tools and methods to dig into this. And the students work in teams to problem solve and create prototypes. And we never have enough time to get to the iteration stage just because mm-hmm. of the structure of the semester, unfortunately. But we do get through the prototype stage. And then the other piece, that's the second piece. And the third piece is giving the students the opportunity to think about how the elements of human-centered design, again, these mindsets and tools, can actually help them solve legal problems. So we have legal services delivery, right? That's like how we are interacting with the client, how we're serving the client, how we're designing the service, how we're delivering it. Then there's the actual work we do. And I believe, and this has been my experience in my practice, that There are certainly elements and mindsets of human-centered design that can make us better legal problem solvers. So not just more effective in how we communicate with clients, but actually if we consider empathy, true empathy, true intellectual empathy, cognitive empathy, a foundational lawyering skill, that really, from a design perspective, looks different than how we're taught to issue spot in law school, for example. It's much richer, much broader, and really requires us to take the perspective of the client who we're problem solving for. And I do not think that most people have a law school experience that teaches them to truly take the client's perspective before they start trying to solve the problem. And so we talk about how these methods can actually be superpowers, super lawyer powers, right? That truly go to how to think like a lawyer better. And so that's what the course is about in a nutshell. It's a whole lot of fun.
Yeah. Sounds, I think every law school should provide a course like that. Definitely.
Yeah, because that actually coaches the students for the real life and the real work.
Yes.
Yeah. Brilliant idea, Kat. This is just brilliant.
Well, it is, I just made the thing that I needed, right? Like once I had, 20 years of experience, I can now look back and say, okay, what would have empowered me? What would have given me the tools that would have helped me do better and be better sooner? Mm-hmm. And so I designed backwards, right, with my end goal in mind, based on, my lived experience and a lot of research. A lot of other disciplines, specifically the business world, have looked deeply into how human-centered design just improves everything about the way we work. It improves profit. It improves the happiness of people doing the work. It certainly improves the happiness of the people receiving the service or buying the product. And so for me, it just makes sense that we think about how can these elements work to do the same in the law. And I will go back to a point I made, I believe I made earlier in our conversation, that for me, applying human-centered design to the delivery of legal services absolutely takes into account those of us doing the work. Mm-hmm. And in the U.S., statistically, the research shows that we are much more depressed, anxious, suicidal, and alcohol and drug reliant than the general population. And one can simply look at how our work is traditionally structured. And it is, I think it just defies logic, reason, and reality to say that that is not one of the reasons why we are statistically so much more depressed, anxious, suicidal, and drug and alcohol addicted. And so I think when we are reimagining how we do our work, when we're reimagining our systems of justice, we must take into account the folks doing the work. As I said, it's not an either or, it's an and. We can create better ways. And frankly, I think when we create ways that empower people to help themselves, that takes a whole lot of pressure off of lawyers, yeah. Right? Yeah. Like we will never be enough, and we will continue to become much more stressed, depressed, and anxious mm-hmm. if we continue to try to carry the weight of the world on our shoulders and be the only ones who can help. And so I think that that's one of the many amazing opportunities we have when we really sit down to rethink and redesign mm-hmm. how we're doing things.
Yeah. One question about from how to change the legal education approach to be more like multidisciplinary and teamwork like. I think for many, because I have some little experience from teaching law myself, and I think the easiest solution for a teacher to test is if the students have learned something, it's just give them the book and then make a test, an exam out of it, and then just grade the papers. And many teachers may think this is easiest for them, but so they need to kind of make the trade between the traditional way of testing knowledge and learning results, and then they need to make the change in their own work, and that they may think, okay, where do I get the energy for this? So how would you sell this different approach to the teachers who actually really have the power themselves to make this happen?
So, I think you hit on a core issue, and that is folks need to have the will or the impetus to do things differently, right? And I haven't yet figured out the magic way to really motivate those who are not at all interested in changing into change. And I think the way higher education is structured, at least in the US, I don't see external pressure being exerted anytime soon. So my response is going to focus on those folks who are interested in making a shift and who want to iterate and who want to be effective in the 21st century. And I think it essentially is the same thing I tell my students. If you want to make change, you can start small where you are with what you have, right? And so I think a teacher, it's exactly what I do. I identify an opportunity, a way that I believe will work well to help my students learn these core skills. I identify, again, I design backwards with the end goal in mind. What are the core skills I want to impart? And how can I create opportunities for the students to practice gaining those skills? And I think any teacher has the opportunity to do the same thing. And it can be as simple as just creating one activity, one opportunity, integrating that into the way you've been doing it for years, right? It doesn't have to be a wholesale, throw everything out that you've been doing and doing it all new. You know, it doesn't have to be tabula rasa. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. So I think you can run small experiments, right? It's a classic design method to, design a way that you think is going to meet the end goals and then test it out and iterate as you go. Ask for feedback from your students. I'll tell you, it is terrifying to ask for feedback from your students.
Oh, yeah. I bet.
You know, and how else can you know what the experience was like for them unless you ask? And, you know, the standard course evaluations that students, you know, fill out at the end of the semester for all their classes, those aren't designed to help the teachers improve. They just don't have the opportunity for the granularity, and they don't allow you to ask the questions in a way that tests your hypothesis to know if your experiment works. So those don't count. I mean, you know, really asking for the students' feedback. What was your experience? Like asking questions that are geared to get to, did they get out of it what you were anticipating they would, what you wanted them to? And so it's constant iteration. You know, my husband, I've been married for 25 and a half years now, and he complains all the time that, like, I'll make something awesome for dinner and then I'll never make it again. Like, but I really like that. And I'm like, but I've moved on to the next thing. So I have a tendency to be like the serial experimenter, right? And I do that a lot in my classes. And, you know, I realize I'm going to completely burn out if I don't figure out a way to like stick with some things. I got advice early on that, yeah, you'll design it and then you'll do it once or twice and then you'll just keep doing it that way. And I'm like, I don't think you understand what I teach. That's just, that's not how it works. But I do think that, again, all of us have the opportunity to to try something. And I also think that there are an incredible array of resources available. If you just look around, if you ask your colleagues who you see doing interesting things, right? Mm-hmm. I do this all the time. I learn by just following a bunch of really interesting and effective teachers on Twitter, and they share about something they're doing. And so then I'll reach out and then, you know, tell me more, and we'll trade activity descriptions, we'll trade syllabi, well, you know, and so you just start doing things. Like you put on the designer mindsets and you start living it.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that all your students love this. I mean, it sounds great. And seems like you have asked feedback from them. What kind of feedback have you got?
Well, as I had shared with you all before we started chatting, I last semester assigned my laws of business students a project. They worked in teams of, I think they worked in teams of five. This is the class I had 120 students. And for a little bit of context, the course was designed for 24 students. And I learned about 2 weeks before classes started that in fact I had 120. So I had almost 100 students more than I had designed the class for. And so what I had planned was not going to work because it was very interactive and it required my interaction with the student teams. And I simply would not physically be able to do this with 120 students. So I had to completely start from scratch. Okay, what can I do that's going to be meaningful and interesting and fun with this number of students? And so I designed this podcast activity, and this is a great example. Mm-hmm. I, you know, came up with a description for the project, and I gave them some tools to use in planning. And because I'll also say, an underlying goal of every team project that I give students is to explicitly teach them good teamwork skills. And so I use tools and tell them, like, this is a tool to use in your planning so that this is a good experience for all of you, so that you actually enjoy it and have a good product at the end. And this is a tool that real people, like professionals in the real world, use, and you can take it into your practice and use it. And you're going to start by practicing it here. And so, you know, using things like that to give them the opportunity to plan and execute this podcast project, and they did it, and they all did great. And it was really, and they all did different things. And that, in a nutshell, the assignment was to create a podcast episode, a short one. I think the limit was 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and to find and interview a legal professional on some issue that is somehow related to the course subject matter, which is pretty broad. We covered a lot of topics. So I gave them a lot of latitude as to who they interviewed, what they talked about. And I told them, and this was a non-graded, so I didn't assess the end product. It was basically do the work and you get the credit. I wanted them to focus on the process and not be focused on, oh my gosh, am I going to get an A? Mm-hmm. And across the board, they did a great job. And at the end, I sent them, you know, a feedback survey. I'm a heavy Google Forms user for this purpose. And I asked them, like, did you learn something from this? What was the primary thing you learned? Did you have fun? You know, I had a whole series of questions that I asked, and there were a couple, and it was anonymous. If they chose to be anonymous, they could give me their name or not. Yeah. And I had a couple who, I had two to be exact, who answered the question, did you learn anything? No.
Okay.
Which, you know, is not true. It's not. I mean,
well, they were podcast professionals, maybe.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Apparently.
Right. I try to do that, and I will do a similar thing. I've had a different kind of team project that I'm running in both of my courses this semester, where a team of four designs and facilitates a a class session in which they host a guest. And it's a lot of work to host a guest and have a really good, interactive, meaningful session in a class. And so that's the assignment. And I will again ask for feedback after the semester is over on that particular assignment to understand that from the student's perspective, was it meeting the goals that I had set for it? And, you know, did it check the necessary boxes, and what could be better? So that's another example. And then, so, you know, that I would call that formal feedback. And I just try to talk with my students, and that's obviously easier when you're seeing them before and after class and passing them in the hall and having, you know, in-person office hours. And there are still opportunities in the virtual. So I take opportunities when a student comes to me to talk about something, to also ask them for feedback on things. And so to make it hopefully, you know, a conversation in a lot of ways. So I just try to gather the feedback where I can.
I think it's safe to say that no one can make the change by themselves or alone. And there's pretty much, there's a lot of people who actually are trying to make the change happen. They are developers, legal professors, legal researchers, lawyers, designers, technologists who struggle with making the change happen and make their ideas to be seen and heard and being constantly challenged by the traditional ways of thinking and doing. What would you like to say to all those people out there?
Be brave. Find your people. I will say that I created makelawbetter.org as a place for people who want to be active change makers to find others who feel the same way. We in legal innovation must be like water. And by that, I mean this. We can, as an individual drop of water, hit that stone. And in 100 years, we might make a dent in that stone. But we will make a dent by ourselves. If we join others, if we come together as a wave, as a tsunami, we can make great change much more quickly. We also must be like water in this way. We've got to find ways to flow through the cracks, around the barriers, underneath the borders, and really wear the mindsets, I think, of human-centered design to open up our creativity in approaching these really wicked challenges, right? To do what we can where we are with what we have. And I believe that radical collaboration is going to be critical to really moving the needle, especially in the short term. And my hope is that because radical collaboration and empathy and curiosity and embracing ambiguity and becoming comfortable with learning from failure, all of those, you know, core designer mindsets, because they are core, I hope these can also inform how we choose to go out and form collaborative efforts, find other like-minded people, and do the work together. Come together as that wave, as that tsunami. That's how we're going to move the needle.
Thank you, Kat. Thank you for joining us. This was really inspirational.
Yeah. Thank you for being
It was a whole
guest.
Lot of fun. Thank you, Hannah and Nina, for having me. Yeah, this was awesome.
And thank you for listening to the Legal Design Podcast. For more information about us, please visit legaldesignpodcast.com. You can also follow us on our social media accounts on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn.